Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. Recently, we had Ellery McQuilkin on our show to talk about her award-winning work on a disappearing glacier in California's Sierra Nevada mountains, which is amazing, but what makes her even more compelling is she's a high school student, and at age 16, she and her generation are inheriting a world that is clearly imperiled by climate change. So I asked Ellery recently to join me as a special guest co-host in a discussion with three experts on climate change and drought, which is severely impacting the western United States. Along with Ellery, our guests are Leslie Ott, a climate scientist from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Josh Willis, climate scientist and oceanographer from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. Josh is a longtime friend of the show and expert on the role the oceans are playing in melting ice in places like Greenland. We're also joined by another longtime friend and Blue Dot's very own oceanographer emeritus, Bill Patzert. Retired from NASA JPL a few years ago, Bill is still the go-to guy for major media outlets in Southern California on the topic he is most passionate about, drought in the West and how civilization is failing to cope with it effectively. So let's get to the discussion, and welcome to Blue Dot for Leslie Ott, Josh Willis, Bill Patzert, and my special guest co-host, Ellery McQuilkin.
Hi. So we can just start with sort of how did you end up working with NASA? You know, what did you have to do to get where you are today? What path did you take?
Yeah, it's an interesting question because everybody comes here from a little bit different perspective. You know, my parents both studied physics. So in a way, this is kind of the family business, and even though that's kind of unusual. And I mentioned that also because it I think was really important in trying to introduce science as not just a bunch of formulas and units that can seem really dry, but really an interesting way to view the world around you. And so that led to me studying science in college and getting a PhD in atmospheric sciences. So I've been at NASA since right after I got my PhD from the University of Maryland. I've been here for about 15 years. And my work at NASA study is focused on understanding the carbon cycle, which is the fancy way for saying the way that carbon moves through plants and oceans and the atmosphere and comes to affect our climate in the form of greenhouse gases.
All right. Well, that sounds pretty amazing. And like the family, I can see that too, how you can sort of build off of that. Okay, so the Goddard Earth Observing System, I know that's a model you've been working on. So can you describe a little bit about like what it actually is and then how it works?
Yeah, so we call our model GEOS, the Goddard Earth Observing System model that like you mentioned. And really this is kind of a souped up version of one of the models that you use to predict weather, right? And and the model can be kind of a fuzzy term. Sometimes people don't know what that means. But basically when scientists talk about a model, they're talking about a set of mathematical equations that describes the way something functions. So a lot of times when we're talking about computer models, we're talking about really powerful models that are solving bunches and bunches of equations. They actually solve them on a grid that represents all the different parts of the planet. They can solve them super fast on supercomputers. But basically, it's just a set of equations that are trying to describe the way that the planet is behaving. And for us, one of the keys there is that in addition to simulating the weather of the planet, we're simulating things like air pollution and greenhouse gases. So we can get a really full picture of how the planet's evolving.
Okay, so you mentioned that you're using model that's covering all of these different things. So can you tell us a little bit about, you know, where are these data inputs coming from? And then, you know, what is this supercomputer? How is it working?
Yeah, you know, one of the things we try to do at NASA, lots of people run computer models, but one of the things we really try to do at NASA is to use satellite data in a way to really understand the world around us. And so for the carbon cycle, for understanding greenhouse gases, those data are telling us about things like how green the vegetation is, or how the ocean's phytoplankton are evolving. They're also telling us in a global sense about atmospheric carbon dioxide concentration. So they're giving us all these different pieces of the puzzle, but there's still some aspects that satellites can't see. You know, from my perspective, one of the key things we can't observe directly is these exchanges of carbon dioxide between land and atmosphere, ocean and atmosphere. Those end up being really important because the land and the ocean absorb about half of human carbon emissions. So it's really critical that understand in detail where all this carbon is going. So what we try to do is stitch together with all these models, these mathematical equations. We try to integrate those models with satellite data to give the just the fullest and most complete picture of carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases that we can. And as you can imagine, that's a pretty big enterprise. We got all these models, we've got, you know, literally millions of lines of code. And that involves running on the supercomputers, which we have also right in-house at NASA, just, you know, a few buildings over. We've got a supercomputing center with a big room full of computers. And one of the things that's really exciting about that is getting a chance to work with not just scientists, but also mathematicians, computer programmers, software engineers. You know, those are the people who are really helping us make progress. We've realized that these problems have gotten so complex, we can't just do it by ourselves. We have to really reach across different communities, different types of experts to be able to make progress with some of these types of resources. And, you know, it's a lot of work to keep track of, but it's also a lot of fun to see the progress.
Yeah, well, that sounds like a cool way you're representing all these different things through the model with lots of different people doing different things. That's a pretty amazing way to represent that. So within that, when you're working on these models and trying to get the accuracy and precision that you want, what are some challenges in that? And, you know, like, what does it involve? Who are you working with in that process? Who's involved in that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, right? Because you always know a model is some, you know, set of equations that we're trying to represent the way the world works, but we always, you know, have to make approximations. Nothing is ever perfect. One of the big challenges that we have in our type of modeling, where we're trying to rely as much as we can on the satellite data, is that even though the satellites have given us a much fuller picture than we ever had of some of these types of processes and quantities, we still have some gaps in really important places. So, you know, for example, let's take atmospheric carbon dioxide. That's something I spend a lot of time looking at. Right now, our satellites give us a chance to see a certain point on Earth about every 2 weeks, but they can only see when it's cloud-free. So you can imagine places are cloudy a lot. You know, pretty soon you've got a month, even 2 months without observations in a key place. And that's not great. And some of the places where we have really big questions we want to answer about vegetation, about the carbon cycle, are really cloudy, like Amazon rainforests. And so a lot of the work that's going on right now is to try to figure out, can we build satellites that give us much more complete data because they can sample more frequently? So this is something NASA's working on. It's something that our European colleagues are working on. And so some of the challenges are just trying to fill in the gaps so that we can get more precise answers, we can reduce uncertainty and give people greater detail in the spatial domain to answer some of the questions they need. And the second thing that we're trying to do is to integrate our models a little bit more. Right now, I've got a separate model that simulates the ocean. I've got a separate model for the land, separate model for the atmosphere. And increasingly, we're trying to put all of those pieces together. So we've got one integrated model. The reason for that is really because there's some important connections between things like the land and the ocean. So for example, if we don't have the land and the ocean talking to each other properly, we might miss really important things like the transport of soil carbon by rivers. So we're really trying to integrate all of these models and have, you know, sort of one large model that describes the whole system. So the, you know, some of the challenges that we're trying to work through are these challenges both on the modeling side and the data infrastructure side of just getting more observations and getting better tools in place. And that's always a continual learning process.
Okay, yeah, that sounds, yeah, you have to get all those different pieces there, but it sounds like you have a lot of them together. You're talking about this integrated model. So when you look at this model that's, you know, connecting a lot of these pieces together, obviously you're saying some isn't, there are a few gaps, but when you look at the overall thing with what you have now, what is it, you know, what is it showing? What are you seeing in terms of, you know, human caused planetary warming? Just what's the takeaway from this, you know, model that you've created?
Yeah, it's you know, this is what we really want to know. At the end of the day, this is why we do it. And, you know, we know when we look at the most recent period that these have been the past 7 years have been the warmest 7 years on record. So we know that climate change is progressing. We know that humans are causing it. And what models are really allowing us to do is to understand in much more detail the processes that are contributing to global warming. And by really understanding the contemporary period, we're trying to build longer term climate projections that are more reliable. So the goal of all of this is to really understand our planet today so that ideally we can predict what's happening in coming decades and centuries. And so all of this work is really helping us understand the sources and sinks of greenhouse gases. And by using satellite data, we're able to do that in a much more complete way than we've ever been able to before. So it's exciting, even though, you know, in some ways it's always hard and difficult to talk about and think about climate change.
Yeah, and I saw, Leslie, that you were the lead on the study that showed that 2020 was the hottest year on record. And I'm wondering, how far back does that record go that you were comparing it to?
Oh, good question. And I will clarify that I'm not the lead. It's a very major effort across NASA, NOAA, and actually a number of international agencies. But I'm happy to play my little part in helping get the word out there. Those data actually go all the way back before 1900. So some of those going back to say like the 1880s. So we do have, in some cases, a very long record of reliable temperature measurements that helps us have good confidence in the change that we're seeing and the fact that the change that we're seeing relative to the pre-industrial period, relative to the middle of the last century is quite dramatic.
Okay, let's move now to my good friend, our good friend, Bill Patzert, also known as the Kahuna here on Big Wave Dave's Blue Dot. And you retired a few years back. And I'm wondering, Bill, are you still getting asked for media, you know, visits and to talk about the drought and California's extreme climate, even though you're retired from NASA JPL?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am. You know, it's compared to the young guys, I'm a lot better looking. And so I look good on TV. So I still get lots of calls, Dave.
Well, yeah, that Southern California media, you got to look good. And can you put California's drought and the current drought into perspective for us? For example, when did this dry period, in your view, when did this start?
Well, you know, and this started with the definition of climate. Climate is what we expect. It's what our grandfathers, our fathers, our ancestors experienced, say, for the last 3 or 4 centuries. But something dramatic happened beginning in the end of the 19th century. The population on the planet exploded from about 1 billion in 1800 to now we're sitting at about 7.8 billion. And we created an entirely new type of a civilization, an industrial civilization. And in the process, we based this civilization on the burning of fossil fuels. And so the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, which is what we call a greenhouse gas, has a very high heat capacity. It tends to retain the heat that it gains. For about 5 million years, it never went above 280 parts per million. But today we're sitting 50% higher. It's now 420 parts per million, and it's had a dramatic impact on the radiation balance of the Earth. We're living in a warmer planet now. The planet is definitely warming. The great ice sheets are melting. Heat waves are more frequent, they're longer. And so we're going to have to deal with this change in the climate, because probably the most significant impact on civilization is climate change. Now, here in California, over the last 60 years, is that the history of California is written in great droughts. California in the American West is basically dry. When you fly from LA to New York and you look down, it's brown until you get to the Mississippi. But in the last 50 years, it's gotten warmer and it's gotten drier. The climate of the West is changing. And we're in the throes right now of what I call a climate crisis in the American West. It's a lot warmer. Heat waves are much more frequent. They're longer lasting. They're more intense. and they're more damaging. So we've been in a drought here on and off for the last two decades, and the average temperature in the West has increased, depending on where you're at, 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, which is 2 to 4 degrees Fahrenheit. It's had a tremendous impact on the economy and the civilization here in the West. Water is scarcer. During these great heat waves, we're always under a power alert. California is the largest agricultural machine in the West, actually in the United States. And the agriculture here in California is totally stressed out. The great reservoirs like Lake Mead and Lake Powell, they're at the lowest they've ever been since we started to fill Lake Mead. Over the last few decades, there's been a tremendous impact on the environment. The rainy season comes later and it leaves earlier. And so the great forests of the Sierras and the Rockies, there are 150 to 200 million dead trees. The ecosystems are changing. They're moving higher. And of course, you know, on days like today, you don't think of it, but the largest single hazard, meteorological hazard for humans are heat waves. And so it's a huge public health crisis.
Let's take a short break, but when we return, Ellery McQuilkin and I will continue our discussion with climate science experts Leslie Ott, Bill Patzert, and Josh Willis. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back. Let's return to our panel discussion with my special guest co-host, Ellery McQuilkin, and climate scientists Leslie Ott, Bill Patzert, and Josh Willis. So it's definitely impacting our lives here in Northern California and the West dramatically. People in Portland are not used to this. And, the other thing you mentioned is, you know, how dry it is. And you sent an email out. Ellery, you want to ask him about that?
Yeah, Dave forwarded me that email you sent out that was showing the water deficit in California. So, you know, it's obviously been a really dry year. I was just backpacking in Yosemite. Something we saw moving water like twice, and lots of dry rivers, lakes lower than usual. What's the takeaway from that? Are these super low numbers? Are these really going to become the new normal? You know, like sort of what are your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, all great civilizations are built really on two things, the availability of water and the ability to feed their population. Mm-hmm. And here in the American West, we're in a crisis with regards to water. Is that many farmers are fallowing their fields in the Central Valley, in the San Joaquin Valley. There are wells that are going dry, so there are communities with no water. And so the buzzword around California is use less water. And so we're all inoculated with what we call the conservation vaccine here in the West. And it's a crisis. We haven't dealt with it. And one of the worst things is that it's so dry here in the West and it's so warm is that the fire danger has completely gotten out of control. We've had some dramatic fire seasons. Here in Southern California, our fire season was usually in the fall and the winter. Now it's year round And already this year, we've had more large forest fires here in the West than we had last year. And last year was record breaking. So
yeah, I definitely remember last year, the smoke where I lived.
So I don't exaggerate when I say we're in a climate crisis here in the American West.
Yeah. And Ellery, could you expound a little bit on, tell us where you went backpacking? And I know you were with your dad, and I'm sure he's been in that area where you went many times before. How did it compare to what, you know, you guys have seen in the past? Tell us, you know, give us a description of what it was like in the Sierra.
Yeah, so we were backpacking in Yosemite, sort of on the west side. So generally, that's the wetter side. But, you know, it was the first, I think, 4 days, we really didn't see moving water. And we camped at this one lake. So, you know, we had water, but there was like no outlet coming out of it. It was much lower than usual, murky. And then in a lot of the lakes, there were these sort of algae blooms that look kind of like donuts that really are not in those alpine lakes. They're moving up with the warming water temperatures. So, you know, there's just, you could really see the dryness. There were a lot of dry riverbeds, a lot of a bunch of mosquitoes. So, you know, you're just sort of getting all of the different things piled on top. And definitely a big change. Normally that area is very wet, lots of running water. So we sort of just, we're seeing right there then, man, you know, climate change is already definitely affecting us in big ways. And then these smaller things that you sort of just pick up after being in an area for long enough.
Yeah, so you saw it firsthand. Well, let's move to let's talk to Josh Willis a little bit. Josh, you're from NASA JPL, and you're an oceanographer, and your big project the last few years has been called OMG, which stands for Oceans Melting Greenland. So can you tell us what's the big picture of what's happening in Greenland briefly, and for those of us who haven't heard from you before? And you know, what's going on in Greenland? What's your latest findings?
Well, thanks, Dave. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And it's always a pleasure to talk about OMG. This is a mission that we started about, it's in its sixth year now, sixth and last year. And the idea was to fly airplanes around Greenland and try and answer the question, how much are the oceans eating away at the ice from the edges? You know, Greenland is covered by this gigantic ice sheet that's 2 miles thick, and it's melting. The planet's heating up, it's melting. And we think of it as sort of like a big ice cube under a hairdryer, but really all that ice is actually sliding off the land into the water, and a lot of it touches the ocean directly. And so what we're trying to figure out is how much are the oceans actually responsible for the ice being melted away, really from below.
And are you going to be returning to Greenland anytime soon, or are you kind of wrapped up there?
No, we got one more year. This August, we're headed back to Greenland, if all goes well, with COVID and everything. And we're planning to do one more big survey. So every year we drop about 250 sensors in the ocean, and these fall down through the water, and they tell us how warm the water is, not just at the surface, but all the way down deep. And it turns out that's really important, because the warm water around Greenland is actually about 500 or 600 feet below the surface of the ocean. So you have to get way down deep in the water before you can really measure these warm temperatures and see what's eating away at the glaciers there. Plus, we get to fly around in this old DC-3 airplane, they call it a tail dragger, because the tail is all low. So when it's sitting on the ground, it's all sloped inside. But it's really a cool plane and an exciting mission.
Is Alfred Wegener still safe entombed in the ice, or is he going to be melting out of there soon?
You know, it's a good question. I mean, the reason we're doing this is because Greenland is melting, and it's not just melting, it's melting faster and faster almost every year. And what we're seeing is that the ice is retreating from the edges. So these glaciers, which are really like giant rivers of ice that carry the ice down into the ocean, they're speeding up and they're spitting out the ice more quickly. And what we've discovered over OMG is that has a lot to do with how the ocean is changing. So in fact, we had a big surprise in our first couple of years of OMG. The largest glacier and the most probably the most important glacier in Greenland, which is called Jakobshavn, it had been retreating steadily for about 20 years before we started. It actually started growing in the first couple of years of OMG. And we found out that a natural cycle had sort of coughed up some colder than normal water onto the continental shelf, and it had bathed this glacier. And it was a big relief, apparently, because the glacier started growing again. Now, in the last year, we've found that the natural cycles ended and the warm waters returned. And of course, it's shrinking again. But these kinds of discoveries, they help us better predict what the glaciers are going to do down the road as the whole planet heats up, as the water heats up, and as the air heats up.
Dave, can I ask Josh a question?
You may.
You know, Josh, many people say that the unequivocal proof of climate change or global warming is that the sea levels are rising. Maybe you can explain that to us.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a great question, Bill. So, of course, the oceans cover more than 2/3 of the planet's surface. And so anything that's happening to the whole climate is definitely happening to the oceans. And it turns out that they also absorb over 90% of the heat that's trapped by the greenhouse gases. It's actually warming the oceans. And that causes the water itself to expand and rise. And that's about 1/3 of modern day sea level rise. And the rest actually comes from melting glaciers and ice sheets, like in Greenland. In fact, Greenland all by itself is about 1/6 of modern day sea level rise. And it's like I said, it's melting faster and faster every year. So watching the oceans rise around the planet, in a way, it's kind of like watching, the pulse of the whole climate. And it goes up and down a little bit every year, but overall it's rising. It's rising as the planet warms, it's rising as the ice melts, and it's really our yardstick for how much humans are interfering with the climate.
So all those disappearing beaches in California, that's the proof of global warming, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. It's the disappearing beaches and the disappearing glaciers. In fact, actually, Ellery, I heard that you're something of a glaciologist yourself. Is that right?
Well, I've been doing research on the Dana Glacier, so it's a very, very small compared to what you're working on, Cirque Glacier, which is in Yosemite near where I live. So I've done pretty in-depth research on this one. I can't say I have a lot of experience with larger glaciers. but yeah, I've spent a lot of time on the Dana Glacier.
Briefly tell Josh, you know, what have you found about the Dana Glacier?
Yeah, well, so... In 2019 to 2020, I measured the movement on the Dana Glacier. So it is still moving. It moves, you know, about 3 meters a year. So it's very small compared to other ones, and it's quite slow. Also considering it has a very small depth of about 596,000 cubic meters. So it's kind of miraculous that it is still moving, but it's on this super steep slope, which is sort of accounting for aspects of that. I calculated the volume this last summer, which was a challenge, especially because a lot of the tools you might use on a larger glacier aren't as effective on this tiny glacier that has an average thickness of, you know, 13 meters. It's been a really incredible experience. A sad one, because the Dana Glacier is going to be gone in about 8-ish years. I sort of got to document the disappearance of this glacier, which has been really valuable.
Wow, eight years, that's really soon. That's like
I'm doing some more research this year to get more precise ablation measurements, but some sort of ones I'd gathered offhand in the previous years, it's melting vertically about 4 meters a year, and the deepest part of the glacier is about 30 meters thick. So there's not a lot left of it.
Wow. to me, the thing that's really amazing about glaciers is that they're kind of alive, right? That's,
yeah.
They're moving. That's why it's a glacier.
Yeah, that's definitely, that was the first time I went on the Dana Glacier. We were standing on it. And at that point, I had really not expected that it would still be moving, but we felt this jerk that was, you know, in the, it, so we sort of felt the glacier move in that way. And it was a kind of miraculous moment. And then going up in the ice caves underneath other glaciers, that's, they really are this like living thing. That's a really amazing experience.
That's awesome.
Wow. Yeah.
Well just to give you a little history here. In 1965, just after I completed my bachelor's degree, I spent a summer up on the glaciers in southeastern Alaska.
Oh, wow.
See, what was that? That was 1965. So that was over 50 years ago. And many of those glaciers have almost disappeared today. And, but it was a great summer, and it really piqued my interest in climate change. It really set me on my path.
Wow, that's cool. Okay, let's bring like everybody back together. And I'd like to kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about some of the bigger issues involving this and you as scientists and your opinions on them. Let's talk about the challenges of communicating about climate change, you know, politically, you know, and you had this pandemic on top of it the last year. Like, for example, Leslie, I'd like to start with you. I was looking at a YouTube video that was posted by you talking about some of the extreme weather events that happened in 2020. And it was very interesting and very well done. And, but then when I looked at the comments down below, it was just like, it was OMG, but not oceans melting Greenland. There were some just ridiculous comments down there. So I just wanted to get your perspective on that.
Yeah. And that's a good, you know, I never read the comments for those reasons. I think you just, you know, you do your best to communicate the facts and what you're seeing. And that's all you can do. And you try to meet people where they are and understand where they're coming from. If it's possible to understand some of the reasons that they're having trouble accepting climate change, whether it's, you know, a lack of background, whether they've been fed some bad information, you know, you try to counter it where you can. But I think ultimately, you know, all you can do, all any of us can do, is just stick to the facts and do our best to communicate them to a broad audience. You know, COVID was actually a pretty interesting time for trying to communicate climate change, because there was so much going on and people had this sort of renewed interest in the environment, probably because you're home and you're looking out your window and thinking about plants in a way you've never thought about them before. And so, you know, even though people were distracted because they had so much going on in their lives, you know, we had a lot of interest when we would do climate stories, when we would do interviews, you know, people were really engaged and trying to understand the impact of COVID on their environments. They really wanted to understand what this meant for climate change. You know, what does all this mean? And so I think, you know, if there was one small silver lining from the climate communications perspective, obviously it was it's been a devastating year, but, you know, I think we were able to, in a lot of ways, break through to some people. Of course, not everybody, but I think people were open to climate stories more than we might've anticipated going into a massive pandemic like that.
Anybody else?
Well, I'd just like to say that with regard to communicating climate change, I think most scientists have done really an excellent job, and the media has become more friendly to climate stories. But the country is quite polarized with regards to science. So communicating the climate story is a lot like the coronavirus story. Is that, it's common sense. Most people get it. The world is warming and we have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, and we also have to get vaccinated. It's common sense. So the problem is that to do anything about climate change, it's a global problem. The problem has to be legislated and it has to be enforced. It's more than just driving a Prius in upper middle class neighborhoods. So scientists have to continue to communicate and convince people that climate change is real. We have to wean ourselves off fossil fuels in the same way we have to get vaccinated. And so we're in this for the long haul, and it's the big picture. It takes everybody because we all share the atmosphere.
Josh?
Yeah, and I think another thing that we kind of have to come to terms with in communicating about climate change is to realize and accept the fact that there are people and organizations who are just producing a lot of misinformation. And, a lot of the kind of hostility towards scientists like us and people working on climate change, and even just people trying to talk about it, comes from misunderstandings that are not accidents. And I think, we have to continue to talk about it, in part to help people understand that it is real and that it's something we have to do something about, because it's there's a lot of people with the opposite message out there, and pretending that they don't exist doesn't make them go away, as we found out.
Yeah, and there's so much misinformation that is being parlayed on social media, especially places like Facebook, where it just becomes this echo chamber and you get people kind of like radicalized into a point of view that really has no basis in evidence or reality.
And Dave, just to simplify it to its simplest mode, the most important thing that people can do is vote. And vote for sensible legislators, all right, at a local level, at a state level, and a national level that will sponsor legislation to wean ourselves off fossil fuels, to get ourselves vaccinated. And, of course, this has to translate to an international level, too. But be very careful who you vote for.
You're listening to a special edition of Blue Dot. As we examine climate change as record-setting heat is taking lives in the western United States, we're going to take a short break, but stay with us, and we'll continue our discussion with my guest co-host, high school student Ellery McQuilkin, and our guests, NASA climate scientist Leslie Ott and Josh Willis, along with retired NASA JPL oceanographer and California drought expert Bill Patzert. And we're back, and thanks for listening to our climate change special with my guest host, Ellery McQuilkin from Lee Vining High School in California, and our climate science all-star panel with Leslie Ott from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, Josh Willis from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and our own oceanographer emeritus, Bill Patzert, who's an expert on how climate change is amplifying drought in the western United States.
You touched on a little bit about, what people can do. And obviously, many of the issues are coming from big fossil fuel industries. But do any of you have thoughts alongside with voting about what is something effective that individuals can do that in, maybe it's a small way, but something you can do that will help with this problem?
Here's an interesting fact. What we're talking about here is CO2 in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. It turns out, if you look at the world's population, the upper 2% affluent of the world's population produces more CO2 than the lower 50%. All right?
Wow.
So it's an affluence problem. It's a technology problem. All right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a population problem. And so the affluent nations bear the biggest responsibility.
And Josh, any advice?
Yeah, I think in addition to just voting, Remember that you have a bunch of elected representatives whose job it is to represent you. And one of the best things you can do is remind them that you care about climate change. You know, it seems like when you write a letter to your congressperson or your state senator or state assembly person, it seems like it's going off in the void and it doesn't matter, but it actually does. They do pay attention to what their constituents want. And you have a bunch of elected officials. You know, there's federal ones, there's state ones, there's city ones and so forth. And the more you talk to them about climate change, the more likely they are to actually do something about it. And for them to actually carry out their, you know, their legislative duties and change things, which is what at the end of the day, like Bill said, that's how it has to change.
Yeah, it just as an example, this contrasts the previous administration with the present administration. The previous administration actually denied global warming and climate change. The new administration in Washington is trying to legislate against climate change and global warming, trying to wean us off our fossil fuels, all right, and get us onto a renewable energy economy. So what a difference. What a difference one election makes, right?
Right.
It just emphasizes the importance of how you vote and who you vote for.
Yeah. My next thought is, you know, I just, this last year for me personally has been difficult where I live. I've been in the center of the massive wildfires of 2020 and the extreme drought. That's, you know, it's really depressing and worrisome about the well that, you know, that I rely on. You know, you look at the constant parade of extreme weather events, like Portland being 115 this past weekend and still dealing with that as I speak. I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, you know, not just as a scientist, but as a citizen and a person, when you see these things going on, you know, fires in Australia, Northern California, the melting ice in the polar regions, the weird exaggerated size of the peak and trough of the polar jet that, you know, brought all that cold air into Texas and has kept the Pacific Northwest locked in this drought mode. Leslie, I'd like to start with you. You know, what are your feelings about that as you just observe this, you know, because you work at it, but as a person, what do you think when you see all this going on?
I think obviously as people, you look at some of those stories and particularly the way that it's affecting people, right? Because at the end of the day, that's why we care, is that this is affecting people's lives in very real ways. And I think you can't help but be touched by that. And that's hard, you know, and I think so on a citizen level, I think we engage with that probably the way that many other people are with you know, sort of concern and alarm. And I think, you know, for me, being a scientist maybe makes me feel slightly more hopeful because I don't feel as powerless. I feel like, okay, there's this horrible thing going on. You know, what could I do to contribute in a little way to some of these disasters, or to give people better information? So, you know, our models also predict fire emissions and help inform people about air quality. So can we make that better? Can we, you know, do a better job of getting information to people? And so I think that, you know, there's this part of the reaction that's common to just, you know, being horrified by what you're seeing, but also, you know, trying to divert that into some sort of positive action and really double down to make a difference and do the best that you can in what is obviously very difficult circumstances.
Yeah. Josh, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it's alarming to see these things play out. But, you know, if you're a scientist and you understand how climate change is happening, it's not unexpected. I mean, we're seeing these things play out that have been predicted for decades now. I think what's alarming to me really is the reaction to it or lack of reaction to it. I think people are only still slowly coming to grips with the fact that we really will have to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels, and doing that's going to be hard. And so to me, I think it's more the part that's more alarming is that, you know, action, particularly at the federal and global levels, are too slow. But I'm curious too, what's it like to still be in high school and see all this going on? Ellery?
Yeah. You know, it's it's upsetting because I definitely feel like, you know, I'm going to be living through a lot of the more severe effects of climate change. And, you know, a lot of the adults right now are sort of like, this is happening and it's happening. It's obviously happening now, but a lot of the most severe impacts are going to be happening sort of, you know, to my generation. So I think it's very disheartening to see that many of the adults who are in positions of power and in the government who could be enacting big changes to make, you know, climate change more fair, to try and deal with the racial inequities that are also involved with climate change. You know, I think that it's very disheartening to see that little change has happened there. And with the new administration, I'm hoping for more, but I also do feel like my generation is, I think we're more aware of it. And in some ways that's because of social media, which also has its downsides in sort of spreading misinformation. But I think that people are more aware of it. And I think that I have hopes that that will lead to more changes coming.
Well, just on a positive note, is that most social change or industrial change is driven by economics. And it turns out that renewable energy, that means solar energy and wind energy, they cost less than fossil fuel energy. And so here in California, we're making a huge transition onto renewable energy because it makes economic sense.
Right.
So if you want your power bill to be less, vote for renewable energy, not the dirty energy. And so in many ways, if there is a revolution in renewable energies, it will be driven by the economics, right?
Yeah, I think that that's a way to look at it, but in some ways it's sad because people aren't going to get on with it just because it's this bad thing that's negatively impacting the environment. But there is that positive note that in some ways just the economy will eventually drive us in the right direction, which is, it is comforting.
Leslie, anything you want to add to tell Ellery at age 16 about, you know, the world that she's going to be living in?
I think, it's tough. I think one of your biggest challenges is sort of what you keyed on, to fight the apathy and to fight the fact that, you know, there is this feeling of unfairness that, like, we've created this problem over many generations, and yet young people are going to be disproportionately affected by it and fighting this battle long after, you know, some of us are gone. And that's not fair and that's not right. And I think it's easy to kind of throw up your hands and say, like, hey, why bother? Are we too far gone? Those are, you know, 5-10 years ago, I used to get questions about, is climate change real? And now when I do interviews, increasingly I get questions of people saying, is it too late? You know, should we just give up? Should we not do anything because it's too hard? And I think that's the thing you really have to fight against. And so looking toward, you know, the places where you do see progress. So Bill's example was really good on the economics. There's also good examples of you know, changes at city and local administrative levels where cities have been very aggressive at trying to reduce their emissions and are succeeding. And, you know, even if there's some, you know, issues getting bogged down at higher levels, at federal levels, you know, there are changes happening around you that are positive. And so I think, you know, that's what I would say, is to really try to fight, you know, and stay positive, stay looking towards the things that are working and know that there is change possible. And also, I'd just like to say for people who are a little bit older, I'm sorry, because we left you with such a mess.
Yeah, you know, well, I think I hope that we'll be able to deal with it. And I appreciate that it seems like all of you are working your hardest to help along with that. On that note of looking at the positive things, the things that are working, I'm wondering, what are some things that all of you think in general, you know, we still can fix? I know from my personal research, you know, the Dayton Glacier, it's going to melt away so soon that at this point, there's not really much you can do about that. But obviously, that's not true for everything. So what are some things that we still really can have a big impact on and try to improve and change?
Okay, let me jump in here. That's a tough one, all right? But, the last couple of years have been pretty interesting because we've lived through a period where there's been tremendous upheaval, especially in this country with regards to human rights and a growing awareness about environmental rights. And of course, this all got mixed in with the pandemic. But right from the beginning, I've always thought that environmental rights and human rights are coupled. Mm-hmm. And so one of the positive things about the younger generation, they're more involved in these environmental issues and human issues than perhaps earlier generations were. And so I think they will have a big impact going forward, looking into the new century.
Well, we're about out of time, but anybody else with some last thoughts? Let's go with Leslie, start with you.
You know, we do have control over our emissions, as Bill mentioned. We've also got control over our ability to sequester carbon by making sure that we manage the landscape, making sure that we manage our forests sensibly. So that is a thing where we can make a positive impact.
Mm-hmm. Josh?
Sure. And I'd just add that, you know, we don't have to see all of Greenland's ice disappear. You know, there's probably still time. It takes a long time for these things to happen, which means that, you know, we have an opportunity, but it's going to take a lot of action pretty quickly to avoid the biggest, most devastating impacts of climate change. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way.
Thanks again to our guests, Leslie Ott, meteorology scientist from NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, oceanographer and climate scientist Josh Willis from NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, and retired oceanographer, drought expert, and longtime friend of the show, Bill Patzert. And a special thanks to my guest co-host, Ellery McQuilkin. Ellery's research on the disappearing glaciers of the Sierra Nevada made her a finalist in both the California State and Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fairs as a student at Lee Vining High School next to Mono Lake near Yosemite National Park. Our longtime commitment to climate science here on Blue Dot is dedicated to her generation as well as our grandchildren's. Because if we don't start making real changes in our economy and shift away from fossil fuels as soon as possible, their lives will be severely impacted by the accelerating warming of the Earth. As I record this at my home studio, I am bracing for yet another round of heat above 110 degrees here in Northern California. This level of constant heat and drought in the western United States may be new, but it certainly isn't normal. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of CAP Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.